Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The American Community Survey poverty and income data for the states is out yesterday, I guess. You can see it on the front page of the Dispatch today and probably across the country. No surprise that the picture is very bleak for the state of Ohio, as it is for much of the country. Nationwide, there are 3.7 million more people and 4.3 more uninsured Americans in 2009 than the year before. Coming up later to talk about the results in Ohio, John Honak, he is the director of the Center for Community Solutions in Columbus, and also Lisa Hamler-Fugit, executive director of the Ohio Association of Second Harvest Food Banks. Right now, Deborah Weinstein, she is executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Coalition on Human Needs, an alliance of national organizations working to promote public policies that address the needs of low-income and other vulnerable people. Welcome to the show, Deborah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do we mean by poor these days?
Well, for a family of four, that would be over about $22,000. Family of three, over about $18,000. So it's not very much money.
Does it? How do we account for nuances like things like increasing cost for health insurance and just the increasing cost of living, that kind of a thing?
The poverty definition really doesn't take those things into account. It's pretty old-fashioned. It was created decades ago, where they did a calculation as to how much a very bare-bones food diet would cost. And at that time, food was a third of a family budget. They multiplied it by three, and pretty much, except for adjusting inflation, that's what it's been all these years. We know that it is not a terrifically complete look at what families really have to spend, and so there are efforts being made to update it. It still, however, is a useful gauge. If anything, poverty is deeper than what it shows, and the trends that it shows from one year to the next are very important for us to recognize.
You often hear about certain programs being available to families with at poverty at, you know, twice the rate or something like that, 100% or 150% or 200% of the rate of poverty. So it's almost as it's like a baseline.
That's right. People running programs, you know, recognize that families who are 200-300% of the poverty line may still be having an impossible time affording health insurance, for instance, or other programs. So so they adjust it upward in recognition of that. But we do need to recognize, as little as it is, there are millions of people, as you say, 3.7 million more poor people in the country in just one year. In Ohio, that was an increase of more than 215,000 poor people in just one year.
And that's from 2008 to 2009. It's fair to guess that there's probably more than that between 2009 and present.
That's right. 2009 was a pretty important year because that was a really the first full year of extremely severe recession, and it shows up in the unemployment levels. We often hear the month-to-month unemployment, and it's pretty troubling, but if you look, for instance, nationally, from 2008 to 2009, the percent unemployed rose from 6.4% to almost 10%. That's a huge jump. In Ohio, it was worse, went from 7% to 11.1%. Again, over a one-year period, that's an absolutely huge increase in unemployment, and it is directly related to the high levels of poverty that show up in that year. But we know that 2009 isn't the end of the story. Look around, we know that there is still high unemployment, high hardship levels among families across Ohio and the country.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Deborah Weinstein. She is executive director of the Washington D.C.-based Coalition on Human Needs. We're talking about the American Community Survey on Poverty and Income Data. It was out yesterday. It's on the front page of the Dispatch today. If you want to take a look at it there, you can also go online, I'm sure. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Gosh, Deborah, it seems like I'm having a show about poverty or poverty-related issues every other day.
Well, you're covering what people are experiencing. And the thing that we hope people will take out of this is that as serious as poverty is, the response oughtn't to be just, you know, isn't that terrible? The response is we must take action. For us, these levels of poverty are a state of emergency. And when Americans are in an emergency situation, they have always come to the rescue. And Congress did some of that at the beginning of the recession. And it shows up in the Ohio statistics. They increased the amount that was available for food stamps and helped more families to get it. In Ohio, food stamps reached more than 12% of all Ohio families, up from under 10% the year before. We don't want families to have food stamps, but it is good news when they need it that they can get it. And they got help through tax credits, and they got help through temporary jobs. Ohio's spending $56 million on temporary jobs that they got from the federal government. And, you know, that's going to expire on tomorrow if Congress doesn't act. And it isn't likely to act in time, although maybe they can make it retroactively available again. But this is the point. There's something that can be done. Not enough has been done so far, but it looks like Congress is turning away from continuing and expanding the assistance that will reduce poverty and let people get back to work.
In your, you had a Huffington Post article this week. You said that the Census Bureau reported that if food stamps and low-income tax credits were counted in its poverty calculation, the data would show that about 4 million people were lifted out of poverty.
That's right. In fact, that was even a somewhat understatement, as we saw more statistics. 3.6 million were lifted out of poverty or would have been lifted out of poverty by the food stamp increase alone, and some millions more from the tax credit. So those are things that work. Are they doing enough? No. We need a comprehensive strategy that gets people back to work and continues to provide this assistance when people need it.
You know, you hear the talk about we need jobs, but government doesn't necessarily create jobs. What are the sort of things that you think government could be doing to encourage job creation?
Well, government can create jobs very directly in some ways. Temporary jobs, as it's doing now, for the lowest income people. Obviously, you can hire more teachers and other people that get state or local government jobs. But it also can, by putting money in the hands of low-income people through something like the food stamp benefits or unemployment insurance or tax credits, they go out and spend that money. And economists tell us that that's one of the best job creators, because if it's being spent in a supermarket, that's money into the economy, and jobs are created for that reason.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, and you wrote in the Washington Post this week, that the new poverty numbers got a muted reaction on Capitol Hill. How so? I define muted reaction, just nothing at all, or?
Well, it varies. Of course, there are champions who are working and trying to do the kinds of things that we're talking about here. But in general, Congress is in a terrible state of paralysis, in which some members don't want to spend money on these programs, will stop them, want to cut food stamps, for instance, in order to pay for other things. making the lowest income people pay the burden for problems of the whole economy and not asking the people with the most money to pay their share. You know, there's a logjam there in part because and I have to say, although we're a nonpartisan organization, it is largely Republicans who have said, we don't want you to act on continuing the tax cuts for 98% of Americans unless we get a tax break for the top 2%. So that kind of paralysis is preventing the reaction to the state of emergency that we are seeing.
Right. The poverty rates are one thing, but the income indicators are the measures on income are very interesting, too. In the United States, the percentage of total income earned by the top 20% is 50%.
Right.
In Ohio, it's 48.7, pretty much the same thing.
That's right. And for, you know, the typical household has lost money in Ohio from 2008 to 2009. The median or typical household income lost $2,000. And frankly, that's been the story all through the first decade of this new century. Even when we were supposedly in good economic times, average, you know, working folks were losing ground or just treading water when the richest Americans were just making out like bandits.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation. And we have a caller from Worthington.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning.
This is a wonderful topic to talk about. I know why the gap between have and have-nots has increased precipitously lately. Not only the tax cuts have something to do with it, but over the years since civil rights movement and the feminist movement, the blacks and the women coming into workplaces, they held back the salaries and wages on the white men, and they were not given equivalent salaries and wages when they enter the workplace. And what happens is that business and corporations make profit, unprecedented profit, by exploiting all these movements and holding back the white male salaries and wages. Did they ever share that with workers? No. They give themselves more higher wages and bonuses. And so what it means is that under Reagan and the Bush administrations, the income tax was reduced greatly for the top 20%. And so you have a tax structure which is tend to reduce their taxation on their wealth and at the same time spread the tax burden to the rest of us so that you have a tremendous pressure put on the middle class and low class. The wages did not even keep up with the inflation rate, and that's why we have such a alarming gap between the have and have-nots today.
Okay. All right. Thank you, caller from Worthington. There is a difference in what we earn today. I mean, our money is the wages are different than what they were 30, 40 years ago.
Well, that's right, and certainly the caller is correct, especially because of the loss of manufacturing jobs, the kinds of jobs that men typically were in. It is true that for decades, men's wages have lost ground, and in fact, some of the reason, as a lot of economists have pointed out, were over the years, families didn't do worse is because women entered the labor force. And what I find interesting, bringing it to today or last year, this new data that just came out, it shows for Ohio that even despite all the rising unemployment, the percent of families that had all parents in the family in the labor force went up. And so that's been the story, that you have maybe people don't have as many hours of work as they had before, but they're working to try to keep up with costs. And so it means that we still need the help of childcare and all these things because everybody's working, but they're just not earning as much. And now we find that there isn't enough work out there, even with all the parents working, to keep up with where people were before. So there's more debt. And at the same time, as the caller mentioned, the people at the really high end of the economic scale are doing better and better.
We have to take a quick break. My guest is Deborah Weinstein. She is executive director of the Coalition on Human Needs. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
It's always a sure sign we're in an election year.
There's mourning in America.
Congressman, since you spend most of your time golfing in Florida,
our country is fading and worse off.
I'm Neil Conan. Let the attack ads begin. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to parse the good, the bad, and the ugly. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is here from 2 until 4, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 56 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:23 this morning. Sunshine today and a high of 72. Clear skies tonight and a low of 52. More sunshine tomorrow and a high of 75.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly. On newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, Deborah Weinstein, Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs. It is an alliance of national organizations working to promote public policies and that address the needs of low-income and other vulnerable people. Also, right now, John Honak, he is the director of the Center for Community Solutions. Welcome to the show, John.
Good to be here.
Now, are you one of a member of the Alliance of National Organizations?
No, we're not, but okay. We're certainly happy to be in communication with Deborah and get her emails and would share her views on many of these same topics.
The data released yesterday from the United States Census Bureau and the American Community Survey shows that more than 1.7 million Ohioans, representing 15.2% of the state's population, were living at or below the federal poverty level in 2009. That's an increase of over 217,000 Ohioans when compared to the same data in 2008. Some states are hit harder than others. Is Ohio one of the worst? Or John, where does Ohio stack up?
We are one of the worst. There are some of the Sun Belt states that really had a crash in their housing market, like even Nevada, which was a high flyer in the last decade or so. They've seen a real crunch. Florida, but we've certainly been hard hit. And as Deborah mentioned, this state really has not done well economically for 10 years. And the recession really was a huge blow to families that were already struggling.
What are some of Ohio's special needs?
Well, I think, you know, looking at the state, I think some of the same dynamics that are occurring at the federal level are here in the same way here at the state legislature in Columbus, where there's a real focus on how are we going to shrink state programs, how are we going to cut things, instead of another conversation about who do we need to help, how do we need to help them, and how do we get Ohio families through the recession.
Okay, 614-292-8513. And Pat, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Pat.
Hey, I just wanted to mention that you realize that 46% of the wage earners in this country do not pay any income tax. So you're almost at the tipping point. So what they do, instead of cutting programs, they just raise taxes. And it becomes like a druggie. In other words, you know, and to get the company or the country stimulated, you need to create private enterprise jobs, because then those people who get jobs will pay taxes.
Well, how do you create those jobs, Pat?
Well, you create them by creating demand for their products.
And that means getting money into the hands of.
Right. If the Congress really wanted to help and to stimulate private industry, they would have passed out. They could have taken $5,000 and sent it to every taxpayer in the country, and that would have cost less than the stimulus. And believe me, that $5,000 would have generated a tremendous amount of jobs.
Deborah, do you agree with that? Thanks, Pat.
Well, Congress did provide various kinds of assistance that put money into the hands of the people who would be most likely to spend it, and they didn't do as much as the caller is talking about. That would be a pretty big chunk of change, but they did quite a bit, and it actually did produce some millions of jobs. There's more to be done, and it needs to be a combination of various routes of getting money into the hands of people most likely to spend it right away, easing credit for small business, direct job creation, and you know, and a host of other strategies that will move our economy in the right direction. But Congress did do some of what the caller was suggesting, but just targeted where the economists were saying would have the biggest possible impact.
John?
Well, I just want to point out that, you know, at the national level, we had, you know, significant tax cuts under Bush, and one of the weakest, you know, national economies in the previous decade than we've had since the Second World War, since the Great Depression, really. And we had tax cuts here at the state level, which also were promised to improve economic growth and put people back to work. And instead, even before the recession, we never in Ohio never recovered all the jobs that we lost back in 2001 to 2003. So I think, you know, we just have to be careful about thinking that there's a one-to-one correspondence between cutting taxes and creating jobs. It's not an exercise in, you know, Newtonian physics, where if you fill up something over, take less out of this side and more will fill up over here. You know, the U.S. economy is in a really, you know, precarious situation. A lot of pressure has been building for many, many years, especially the outsourcing of jobs to other countries. That's been going along for a long time. It's really affected a state like Ohio. You know, and in this situation, the Fortune, I read a month or two ago, the Fortune 500 companies are sitting on basically a record pile of cash. So cutting their taxes isn't going to induce, you know, demand that you know, is going to stimulate the economy. There has to be some other, as Deborah said, some variety of approaches here and some creative thinking to move things along.
Thank you, Pat. 614-292-8513. And John, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, John. John? I guess John's not there. I'll put him back on hold. Maybe he went away from the phone. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have an email now from George. Why don't the trillion-dollar tax-exempt foundations provide more of their money for poverty-related causes? In his book, Robert Reich says only about 10% of their money goes to poverty-related causes. I don't know if Robert Reich talked about trillion-dollar tax-exempt foundations, but Deborah, what's your take on where the charitable organizations put their money?
I don't know what the statistics are.
Yeah.
I certainly would be glad if they would spend more on these causes. But the, you know, they're spending them on universities and hospitals and all kinds of things, and those are worthy causes too. I do think that we need a combination of more money spent, including to help low-income people advocate for themselves, so that they're more participants in the political process. But we also need government to carry out its responsibility. I went to an event that Catholic Charities had here in Washington, and they are, of course, one of the largest, if not the largest, private provider of assistance, you know, very largely to low-income people. But a very large percentage of their income comes from government. And so we have to recognize the primacy of government in carrying out the programs that are needed to help low-income people.
You know, there seems to be a big schism in the country right now. There's a whole bunch of people who want government to shrink. They don't want to grow government. They don't want to be in the business of doing the sorts of things that you're talking about. What would happen if these charity programs would just go away? What would happen if social services would just go away, Deborah?
If the publicly funded ones?
Yes.
Well, it would be a disaster. And I've heard we have as members here groups like Catholic Charities, Lutheran Services in America. They unhesitatingly say that there needs to be a partnership of government and the private sector to carry out these needs. It would be a disaster if either side went away. But we do have to recognize that the vast majority of the funding that's spent, whether it's education for low-income kids, direct assistance, food assistance, government dwarfs the resources that the private sector has to provide for these needs.
Okay, 614-292-8513. Tom, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. I just wondered about the figures about the rich taking a bigger slice of the pie. I noticed in the figures that the rich have a no bigger slice of wealth, top 1%, now than they did 20 years ago, whereas their income's up from about 12 to about 20% of the total. That would imply the rich haven't got richer. They've just redeployed their assets to take advantage of low tax rates on income.
Deborah?
Yeah, I don't have the comparable statistics at my fingertips. I know that generally speaking, a look at all of wealth is kind of done separately in separate studies than the look at just income, and it can skew the results. I don't think there's much disagreement that the share both of wealth and of income is increasingly skewed towards the top percents of the of our spectrum here. I don't think it's just redeploying income. I think it's wealth as well. It's certainly true, though, that in the down times of the rotten recession, where, of course, the stock market tanked, that there was certainly some loss of wealth at the top. But most economists feel that that is transitory and that they will make that back fairly soon.
I can just tell you my source of figures. It's Wolf of NYU, a pretty left-wing guy.
Yeah.
And the figures clearly do show that the top 1% have actually not increased their wealth share, 83 through 2007. I mean, that, I think if you look at the figures, you'll see that is the case. I say the only rational explanation I can see, it means that wealth hasn't changed. It's just when tax rates are low, you hold assets producing, say, dividends taxed at 15%. When they're high, you hold appreciating assets like real estate. So the rich haven't got richer. The pie, the slice of the pie, actually slightly down in financial assets, but they just change how they hold their wealth according to the tax structure. I mean, it makes sense.
You mean gold versus stocks and bonds?
Yeah. In other words, if dividend tax rates are 15% and you've got $1 billion, you're going to buy dividend stocks.
Right.
Whereas if they're 70%, you're going to own real estate. The actual wealth of the rich, top 1%. It splits net worth as opposed to, let's say, financial assets. Financial assets have actually fallen very slightly, 83,207. Net worth has risen very slightly in the top 1%. The picture is different for the top 20%. But for the top 1%, I don't think the evidence shows any increase in slice of the pie, I mean, as far as I can tell. I mean, and my explanation is, they don't want I've been able to come up with. Maybe you've got a better explanation. But the figures, I think, are pretty clear.
Okay. Well, I'm not an economist, and I'm not prepared to give the expert analysis. That's an interesting point that we can learn from. I certainly, we do know that the vast benefits out of the tax cuts, which is not directly responsive to your point, but the vast benefits of the tax cuts over the past decade have gone to the highest income. And so if we're looking at the narrower point of whether the wealthiest need additional tax breaks, I think you can make a case that they don't.
John, did you want to say something? Tom, hang on, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I just want to echo what Deborah said. I mean, almost any source that I've seen has the income disparities growing larger. I mean, I think that's basically indisputable. Where the wealthy are putting their assets, obviously is another point. But the conversation we should be having is what are we doing for that bottom 20% or 40% who are struggling, and what sort of policies will help them.
Thank you, Tom. Deborah, I know you have to take off after this. I just wanted to ask you again, what are you looking for in Washington right now in terms of policy at the top?
Well, there are some things that are working. We've learned with this new data how much things like nutrition assistance, like food stamps, are helping. There are threats right now to cut food stamps, and those should be resisted. We know that unemployment insurance helps families in this time of very high unemployment. That needs to be extended. We know that the temporary jobs program that's helping people in Ohio is working. It should be extended. We know that those tax credits that help the lowest income families, as well as the ones that help the vast numbers of people, are needed, and they should be extended. There are a set of policies out there, and Congress is, again, in gridlock and needs to act.
Okay. Well, Deborah Weinstein, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for doing this.
I appreciate it. My guest, Deborah Weinstein, Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs. We will return and continue our discussion about the census data when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Director Ken Burns returns to his exploration of America's national pastime that he began with his landmark 1994 PBS series Baseball. Now Burns updates the series with the 10th inning. This new two-part, four-hour film tells the tumultuous story of our national pastime up to the present. It celebrates baseball's new golden age and sheds light on one of the game's darkest chapters, the steroid era. The series begins Tuesday, September 28th at 8 on WOSU-TV.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, we'll hear a warning that the middle class in the United States is in a dangerous decline, requiring urgent political action and cooperation from both political parties. Joining all sides will be Huffington Post co-founder Arianna Huffington. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And it's 57 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Sunshine this afternoon, a nice fall day, and a high of 72. Clear skies tonight and a low of 52 degrees. Sunshine for Thursday, another nice day with a high of 75. And looks like it'll be sunny on Friday as well, with a high right around 66. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The American Community Survey on Poverty and Income Data came out for the state yesterday. It's on the front page of the Dispatch if you want to check it out there. We're talking about it now, though. Deborah Weinstein, Executive Director of the Washington, D.C.-based Coalition on Human Needs, is going to stay with us. So, Deborah, you're welcome to stay with the show. Also with us is John Hanek. He is Public Policy Director. I guess I gave him a promotion earlier. He's Public Policy Director for the Center for Community Solutions. And joining us now is Lisa Hamler-Fugit. She is Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Second Harvest Food Banks. Lisa, thanks for joining the show.
Good morning.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We kind of do it all here. Lisa, what these numbers are not surprising to you. We were talking about them a couple of weeks ago. You fully expected them. You know, one thing I was reading Arianna Huffington's book to prepare for an interview with her later today, and she points out the increase in poverty in the suburbs. And I was wondering, for your purposes, trying to sensitize people to the needs of the poorest of the poor in this country and their need for just basic things like food, how are you sensing any more empathy from people out there as they see their own neighbors going through these problems?
We do, Anne, and I think that there isn't a person in America that doesn't know someone that's been affected by the Great Recession, and certainly we have seen the demand climbing in the burbs for quite some time as people have lost those high-wage jobs, benefit-providing jobs. They are scrambling to try to find work that doesn't pay a livable wage. They're trying to hold on to their homes. We're seeing home values decline because of the growing number of foreclosures. Interesting, because in preparation for this, I wanted to take a look. The American Community Survey also provides poverty data by congressional district. Mm-hmm. And in looking at both the 12th congressional district that is represented by Congressman T. Berry and the 15th congressional district that is represented by Congresswoman Kilroy, what we are seeing certainly in the 12th district is 44.5% of households earned less than $50,000 a year, and nearly 21% of the households earn less than $25,000 a year. When you move to the 15th congressional district, 51.4% of the people that live in that district earn less than $50,000 a year. And more than one in four earned less than $25,000 a year. So, yes, we are seeing poverty increasing. Another statistic that really frightened me in this release were the statewide numbers. 53.9% of female-headed households with children under the age of five lived below the federal poverty level last year.
And that means to them what? That they, it's, what is that? Tell me in human terms, what does that mean on a day-to-day basis for somebody like that?
They are struggling to try to figure out how they're going to put food on the table, how they're going to pay that utility bill, and where the money's going to come from to pay the rent and put gas in the car. That's what it means, a day-to-day struggle of meeting your basic needs.
So at the state level, we were talking about the federal level with Deborah Weinstein. At the state level, what are lawmakers doing? What are people talking about needs to be done?
Well, certainly not enough. What we're hearing right now is nothing from the two gubernatorial candidates on how we're going to close an $8 billion structural deficit in the next budget, Hundreds of millions of dollars have been cut out of basic safety net programs through the course of the last biennial budget at a time when demand is absolutely skyrocketing. What we need to do is have a frank discussion about where our priorities are. If our priorities are to continue to allow the income gap between the richest and the poorest in our state to grow, as it did last year, where we're allowing our young adults, our parents, and our children who are struggling just to stay afloat, to ask them to make the greatest sacrifice in choosing between food or shelter, that we may be lost. I fear that we are not going to be able to turn it around, because what we're going to see is lost educational attainment, lost productivity, and rising health care costs. We need to invest in ensuring that people's basic needs are met first.
Is the middle class going to bounce back, or is it fading? John, I mean, what's your sense? Because that is what drives the engine of the country.
Well, that's the big question we face in this country for the last 20 years or so. And no one has an answer to that. I think improving our educational attainment is part of the answer in the long run, giving everybody the opportunity to, you know, complete high school, attain some sort of post-secondary education is part of it. But right now, you know, as Lisa said, it's important to meet those basic needs. A kid who is hungry is not going to learn well in school. You know, a family that's struggling just to put food on the table, is going to have trouble, you know, just getting through its day-to-day existence and not going to be thinking about the long term. And those individuals are, you know, they're going to have problems getting to work if they can't put gas in their car. There's a lot of social supports need to be maintained or put in place to help those folks.
Things like emergency transportation for people, those were cut 2 and 3 years ago, weren't they, Lisa? Things like that for people just to get to their job?
Absolutely. At a time when we saw unemployment beginning to rise rapidly in our state, the one program that really helped families with children to be able to get one-time assistance, a wonderful program that was the backbone of welfare reform in Ohio, the Prevention, Retention, and Contingency Program, was cut. Those were modest assistance payments to get a car repaired, to be able to catch up on rent, to be able to buy work clothes. Gutted. Nothing available. So what we have now are a growing number of struggling Ohioans and families going from social service agency to social service agency trying to get any type of basic assistance, and the accounts are empty. We have never seen a time when our not-for-profit and faith-based organizations are in just as bad a shape as more Ohioans. They have no money to be able to keep their rent and utilities on, let alone to try to hold back the floodgates of more people coming to them more frequently for assistance.
614-292-8513. Joe, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. One of the things that's really so sad is that nobody seems to realize that years ago, with the Reagan administration, the trickle-down economy never did anything but trickle down. It never did its job. But the economy at that point was doing okay to where we didn't suffer as much. Now, we went through the booms back in the late 80s and the 90s, and we really started going downhill not too long after the second Bush administration got hold with unemployment and such. But it's been a gradual decline of the manufacturing in this country. Mm-hmm. The manufacturing provided jobs and wealth that the middle class had never been able to attain before, and they dispersed it. They dispersed it quickly. But the trickle-down economy, I always referred to it as a flow-up economy, because the money gets dropped down by government, by businesses, by employers and so forth in lump sums, usually at the first in the middle of the month, and it comes down in big chunks. And all these people that receive it, whether they're on welfare or they're on Social Security or they're on pensions or they're working, they only hold on to that money for days, if not hours. And then they pass it on to the next person in the chain, which would be a small business or a grocery or the gas station, the convenience stores, wherever. Then those people hold on to it just shortly because they pass it on to their suppliers, the utilities, all these people go. And all this time that money is going back up to the top and getting ready to fall again. And I've always referred to it, and I've always thought, I just don't understand these economists when they say a trickle-down economy. You know, you just don't work well getting just bare minimums of anything. You have to be satisfied. It's the same way with the education. The reason all the social programs get cut right away is the fact that the people that are doing the cutting, the people that are making the noise, aren't part of being the recipients. Now, they may be part of the givers, but they aren't the receivers. And this country just doesn't want to come to terms with the fact that the economy rides on the backs of the people at the bottom. It doesn't rise. All the money at the top stays there pretty much. It changes just a few times back and forth, but it normally stays right up there in that 1 or 2, 3% of the people. Mm-hmm. And we don't have any problem. I don't have any problem with that. I just think that they have to comprehend that the whole nation has to stay healthy in order for it to be a healthy nation.
Okay, thanks, Joe. I just wanted to get some feedback for some folks about there's a lot of talk about class warfare in this country. That they're, John, I mean, the people say, no, the people, you can't tax the rich. They're the ones that drive the train. And then there's people like Arianna Huffington who's going to come on next hour and say, no, it's the middle class. We've got to get the money in the hands of the middle class. And bottom line is there's this whole other class of people in this country that have nothing.
Well, I think it's a sad fact that in this day and age, and this has been true for some time, that folks can work you know, full time or close to it, and they cannot support their families. I mean, that's, and you know, the American dream is you know, rewarding work, rewarding hard work. You work hard, you become successful. You know, you can provide for your family, and that sort of social promise, I think, is broken, or is it broken for a lot of people? And we need to have that discussion. And that's not class warfare. That's just dealing with reality. What does it mean when you're only working minimum wage and you have no benefits? And in this Great Recession, things have only gotten worse. If you look at unemployment rates for the poorest households, they're much, much higher than than for the wealthiest. And that only, you know, makes a difficult situation even worse.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That is interesting about the unemployment rates. The more like $150,000 and more, the rate is in the 4 or 5% range, and it just goes up from there. The less money you make, the more likely you are to be unemployed.
And could
yes?
This is Debbie Weinstein. In the Ohio data that just came out, it says that of people who are poor, workers who are poor, more than 1 in 4 haven't finished high school. So again, we need to make some investments in order to make sure that people at the bottom can have more education. Then they will be more likely to be contributors to our economy, as well as doing better for themselves and their families.
614-292-8513. We have a few more minutes. Glenn, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I might be referring back to a previous caller, his talk about how the wealth of the top percent had not changed over the last, I think, 27 years, even though their income obviously has gone way up. And I guess in all the different kinds of things we're talking about, that would play to the tax structure that we come up with. But if their wealth has stayed the same as it was back when the taxes were much higher, then obviously the increase in the change in taxes from back then to now hasn't helped them. If their wealth is still the same and they used to be taxed at a much higher rate, then that didn't hurt them back then. And on the other side of that would be if they're making more money and their wealth is not going up, that means they're not spending that means they're spending their money, they're not saving it.
Okay. They
might be purchasing a cruise, a $10,000 cruise, which doesn't show up in their net worth at the end of the year.
Okay. Thank you, Glenn. People who have everything and they don't need to buy as much. That's the problem.
Well, and I want to make a point here. The American Community Survey talks about income. This is not about wealth. We are not tracking the top 20% of Americans who make that make over $100,000 a year. The data found that they received 49.4% of all income generated in the U.S. This is talking about wages earned, not wealth. So I think it's really important to point out that what the data tells us, again, is income inequity is rising. And if you looked at that tax data, which would then pull in the wealth or savings, the data would be much higher of the income disparity. And I want to go back to what John said. You know, there is something that is morally wrong when people work every day and don't earn enough to be able to provide for themselves and their families.
That's all the time we have. I want to thank Deborah Weinstein, Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs, and also John Hanek. He is the Public Policy Director for the Center for Community Solutions. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Lisa Hamler-Fugit. She is Executive Director of Second Harvest Food Banks. Lisa, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.